Good morning and welcome to the podcast service of the First Universalist Unitarian Church of Wausau. Welcome to our service. Today is Sunday, October 25th. And this morning I'm delighted to be joined by Margaret Jurz on piano and Donika Kozlovich as our vocalist. I say it often, but it is a privilege to serve a 150-year-old congregation up here in North Central Wisconsin. We have served as a vital voice for liberal religion since 1870. No matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, I hope that you know on some level that you are absolutely welcome here. For those of you who have done this for a while, or for those of you who are following along with the order of service we emailed, now is the time that I invite you to join me in our chalice lighting. And the words go. We light this chalice for the light of truth, the warmth of love, and the fire of commitment. We light this symbol of our faith as we gather together. And you're welcome to join in singing wherever you are our hymn this morning, How Could Anyone? Information this morning goes way back to one of our original service books. The affirmation reads like this: Love is the doctrine of this church. The quest of truth is its sacrament, and service is its prayer. To dwell together in peace, to seek knowledge and freedom, to serve humankind in fellowship, to the end that all souls shall grow into harmony with the divine. Thus do we covenant with each other. Now let us join in singing our doxology. The mission and ministries of this congregation is supported by the generous support of people like you. We accept many ways that you can provide an offering. You can go online and give that way on the church's website. You can text a number, which escapes me right now, but it's on the website too. Or you can go old school and mail a check or some cash. But remember that giving, the offering, it is a sacrament of the free church. and it is supported by the voluntary generosity of all who join with us. I hope that you will give an offering and know that it is received in grateful appreciation of our shared hopes and values. So in 2016, while celebrating Holy Mass in Sweden, commemorating ecumenism and the 500th anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, our current Pope, Pope Francis, invented six new Beatitudes based on the original in the book of Matthew. Pope Francis believes that new situations, whether social or political, but especially new religious situations, require new energy and commitment. And so the Pope offered this new list of Beatitudes for modern religious people. Blessed are those who remain faithful while enduring evils inflicted on them by others and forgive them from their heart. Blessed are those who look into the eyes of the abandoned and marginalized and show them their closeness. Blessed are those who see God in every person and strive to make others also discover God. Blessed are those who protect and care for our common home. Blessed are those who renounce their own comfort in order to help others. Blessed are those who pray and work for full communion between all people. All these are messengers of God's mercy and tenderness. With these aspirations in mind, I invite all of you now to join me in a time of prayer and meditation. Wherever you are, center yourself. If you're sitting down, still your body. Put both feet on the ground and take a deep breath. If you're out on a walk, stop just a moment and feel the world around you. And let us journey into silence with these words. Spirit of life, of healing and love and compassion, we bring our cares and pain into this place. We know that in life there are mysteries, mysteries that we will never understand. And yet we know that healing and understanding and love can be found in even the most unexpected places. We pray that our and others' burdens will be lifted, for peace to those who grieve, health to those who are ill or in pain, and forgiveness to those who truly ask for it. We hold in our hearts all who labor, trying to earn food and shelter for themselves and those they love. And as we consider just how great this mystery is, we call to mind our own joys and sorrows as we join together in silent meditation now. Amen. David French, an Army veteran, civil rights attorney, and journalist, opens his latest book, Divided We Fall, with these words. It's time for Americans to wake up to a fundamental reality. The continued unity of the United States of America cannot be guaranteed. At this moment in history, there is not a single important cultural, religious, political, or social force that is pulling Americans together more than it is pushing us apart. We cannot assume that a continent-sized, multi-ethnic, multi-faith democracy can remain united forever. And it will not remain united if our political class cannot and will not adapt to an increasingly diverse and divided American public. End quote. Research shows division and unhappiness are higher than ever. And so in these final anxious days before the election, it seems like a good time to think a bit about our collective future. Election season is prime time for politicians to attempt and bottle up human desire and life's complexity into sound bites. I want to suggest to you this morning that human beings are much larger, more complex, and of more consequence than most politics allows us to believe. We are a multi-faith, multi-ethnic nation with some 330 million people. To assume that everyone's going to be happy because this or that person gets elected is probably self-deception. Now, let me be clear and state that I believe national debates matter. But focusing on them almost exclusively year-round, we might, be making it harder to nurture human fellowship, personal integrity, and a meaningful life. Lately, I've noticed both Trump and Biden invoke the phrase, "Save the soul of the nation." Of course, I have a preference between the candidates, to be very certain, but I don't think either alone can save America's soul. I believe that saving the nation's soul is our job, the people who make it a nation. In a way, all nations are born in the hearts of its people. And so by dreaming and enacting it, we transfer a bit of our soulfulness onto the nation. But just like people can have sickened souls, so too can a nation. I have no doubts that our nation has a lot of soul. But right now it appears buried under the rubble of materialism, greed, and nihilism. In fact, these days, even asking what we as a nation want to become is difficult. And when this necessary question is uttered, our savagely divided political parties, sadly divided religious groups, and self-destructively divided business and environmental groups smash the question into bits. But even then, nothing seems to stop us from putting an extraordinary amount of faith in the work of politicians. We expect them to solve issues that range in complexity from tax codes to when a human life begins. But this is a proven recipe for disappointment and unhappiness. Arthur Brooks, professor of the practice of public leadership at Harvard, suggests three principles for keeping the forces of modern life from ruining happiness. And here's number two. Don't put your faith in princes or politicians. He goes on to quote Mogens Lichtoft, who used to be the Speaker of the Danish Parliament and also the President of the UN General Assembly, who says, and I quote, "Government cannot bring happiness, but it can eliminate the sources of unhappiness." Keep in mind that this was said by a politician from Denmark. And for those of you who don't know, all accounts point that Denmark is the happiest nation on the planet. But over here in the United States, happiness is at its lowest rate in 50 years. And this isn't a recent trend. Americans have been reporting emotional instability in record numbers for years. Fewer children are growing up in two-parent households. There's more depression, addiction, and suicide. And amidst these grim statistics, the nation is dangerously divided. And all of this comes with the recent news that since June, gun sales in the United States are up 145%. I've been watching the World Series. And between innings, the political commercials say, and I quote, "they," and by they mean whatever political party they're not. But in any case, they say, "they will destroy us. They will destroy the soul of the nation." These us versus them ads all but claim that if this or that party wins, it'll spark an apocalypse. As a man of faith, I observe these grim ads and harrowing statistics, and yet my spiritual tradition teaches that everyone is made in the image of God. Now, Unitarian Universalists don't use the old Universalist language anymore, but that exact same idea is captured in the principle that says everyone has inherent worth and dignity, even those we disagree with, I'd like to add. Too many politicians employ reductionism and zero-sum tactics. All the while, this is carried out amidst the awareness that families, nations, religions, and races need others for mutual fulfillment. The journalist Emma Green noted in a recent essay, and I quote, "We are living through a period of crisis in American life in which it is no longer obvious that Americans share a sense of stewardship over our democracy." She goes on to say, our disunity, is evident in the biggest news stories of the day. Crowds of protesters faced off against police night after night, and cities listed off like war zones on the front page. Portland, Kenosha, Minneapolis. Culture war fights bloom over the smallest impositions on our daily lives. People fight about things like wearing a mask to diminish the spread of COVID-19. and our collective anger over politics has spiked dangerously. These political divisions and culture war fights have divided us so much that recent research shows that Republicans and Democrats are now driving different kinds of cars. Republicans and Democrats now watch completely different TV shows, and they even listen to different music. What's worse is that Republicans and Democrats are choosing their friends, where they live, and even the communities they're involved with based almost exclusively on political convictions. But get this, as politics increasingly imposes its will on our lives, Pew Research has shown that only 1 in 5 Americans actually trust the government or its politics. In other words, 80% of us don't have any faith whatsoever in the government or the people we elect, and yet politics guides our interests, our social convictions, our friendships, and even our taste in music and movies. But this distrust isn't confined to politics. It's spilled over into the institutions that once served as the bedrock of America's civic being. Since before the pandemic, people commonly voice that they don't trust their kids' teachers or school administrators, and religious leaders are now among the most distrusted group in America today, and the decline in seminary enrollment and church membership is tangible proof of this. But people don't trust public health officials either. They don't trust City Hall, and they don't trust service organizations. And a result of all this distrust is that we're scared of everyone, and no one knows where to turn for help. As David Brooks notes in a recent essay, failing trust in institutions is bad enough, but it's when people lose faith in each other that societies really begin to fall apart, end quote. And in America, interpersonal trust is in catastrophic decline. According to the National Opinion Research Center, only 30% of Americans agreed that most people can be trusted. 30%. And now, a global pandemic. I expect that this pandemic will be over for years before we learn how it impacted communal life. But already, signs indicate that the year 2020 will go down in the history books as one that exposed the fact that too many people live with constant pain, struggle, and anxiety. But if there is a silver lining to this dreadful year, and I'd like to think there is, it's that 2020 has given us the freedom to question everything, and I mean everything. Just imagine with me, what if our task is to get down to the business of experimenting with new ways of living? I ask this question because it's clear that our current ways of living aren't just ripping us apart, they're in fact killing us. Maybe we should consider the possibility that we're asking just a little too much of politics, and that we should stop hoping and demanding that Washington, D.C. or Madison will one day make us happy once and for all. We should be honest that lots of people have legitimate values that don't fit into any political party. To what party should the anti-abortion environmentalist who supports Black Lives Matter belong? What about the pro-choice, small government, big military person? Perhaps it's complexity exactly like this that led the people in Denmark to think of politics as a tool mainly for reducing unhappiness. The questions I find myself asking are, how can we build a vibrant alternative to this new mainstream? How can we move on from corporations and advertisers that have promised satisfaction but have instead sold us a rat race of joyless production and consumption? What I think we need is what Catholic monks call contemptus mundi. And if you want to know how that translates, it means this: contempt for the world. It's not that monks hate the world, far from it. But what their monastic, sacrificial, soulful lifestyle resists is the values and pop cultural trends that get in the way of cultivating a true sense of individuality and becoming. Now, let me repeat that I believe America has a collective soul, but it's battered and broken by a politics and pop culture that considers anything other than profitability and notoriety unworthy. I don't think it's radical to say that America's soul isn't Democrat or Republican. I think it's safe to say that America's soul will not be fixed by a new invention from Facebook or Google. I don't think a Green New Deal or tax cuts will fix it either. C.S. Lewis said, "Civilization will never be safe until we care for something else more than we care for it." So perhaps it's time we start thinking about what we really cared about. The current struggles over what it means to be America, this deep look into our greatest sins and values, are vital and important. For many people, the fight for equality isn't just about laws. It's about survival, and these fights are necessary. But so much of America's cultural attention on social media, in the news, and pop culture is directed toward life at a grand, almost incomprehensible scale. Now, national debates matter, as I said, but they might also be making it harder for us to be humans with a sense of fellowship and personal direction. And it might be hurting our ability to lead a meaningful life. As the saying goes, maybe we need to learn how to walk and chew gum at the same time again. Or maybe we need to take a play out of my fifth grade teacher's playbook and relearn how to act local as we think global. And with news like ours, it is tempting to feel hopeless. But don't give up hope. When I look around, hope is hard to find. But I do see it out there. I've seen hope in small towns and on the edges of cities, like in the small networks of black schools Emma Green writes about in America Magazine, complete with community gardens and food distribution centers that fashion themselves after the work of Marcus Garvey, the 19th century thinker and activist who argued that freedom for black people can only be won through self-reliance and independence from existing white-dominated institutions. Hope's there in the emerging Catholic communities that resist what they perceive as secularization, and in response they enact Catholic social values of protecting the immigrant, caring for children, feeding the hungry, and aiding the poor. Now, I will freely admit that we might balk at some of these lifestyles. But really, do we have any right to ridicule anyone who's brave enough to live out their countercultural values with humility and dignity? After all, isn't that the kind of grit and vision that defines this nation? Isn't that the kind of spirit that bent the moral arc of the universe a bit closer to justice? Remember that it was people fed up with the status quo who founded universalism because they couldn't keep the truth of God's love for everyone to themselves any longer. And then they broke through glass ceilings, and they went on to ordain women and African Americans. They built daycares and colleges and a humanitarian organization that's won 3 Nobel Peace Prizes over the course of 139 years, when continuously it provides relief for victims of disasters. And they did all of this in the face of a culture that mocked their values and laughed while calling them lunatics. Or what about Jane Addams, who believed that a democracy's health demands that each member of society should be allowed to fully develop themselves? And so she created a communal way of life called the Settlement Movement, sharing knowledge and culture, worked to alleviate poverty, cared for children, and offered free education and health care to anyone trying to help pave the way for them to stake a claim for themselves. What these stories share is a vision of righteousness cast by people willing to transform their lives in order to obtain it. Happiness, that thing our nation promises right after life and liberty, is in short supply. But maybe this is a good time to ask what happiness really is. The Harvard psychiatrist, the late George Valiant, spent most of his career researching happiness. And here's what he said: happiness is love, full stop. When he elaborated, he said happiness is about faith. It's about family and friendship and finding a way in which the work we do earns us success, but also provides a way to serve and truly live with others. In Rosemary Wautola Tromer's poem United, she writes beautifully about living in communion with people, even people we disagree with. And here's her poem. Over 30 years later, I still remember the night when my brother and I stood in the kitchen and argued the merits of Grape Nuts versus Cap'n Crunch. Potassium, potassium, potassium. I still hear him chanting, the one nutrient his cereal has more of than mine. Breakfast was the least of our differences, but it taught us to laugh as we disagreed so that later, when the stakes were higher, presidential elections and gun laws, we could argue till I cried and then snuggle on the couch. Though we seldom agree, though we will forever cancel each other's votes, though I will never eat Cap'n Crunch, I still sit with him as he eats it, laughing, shaking my head, grateful he teaches me so much about how I am not. He will celebrate me, and he will buy me any damn cereal I want. And though we disagree about almost everything, except how much we love each other, we are two threads in a civilization that would try to make us believe we couldn't be one cloth. But we are. Woven tight, we are. Never forget that we are much larger, more complex, and of more consequence than our politics or culture suggests. Try hard, but don't lose hope. And keep fighting the good fight, but as you do, recognize that there are far too many forces in our nation trying to divide us. And so long as we are divided, we lose out on gathering with people who are different from us, people who can teach us what we're not and show us what we don't know, things we haven't even noticed. Our task is to learn how to value one another spiritually, culturally, and even politically. Progress is not inevitable, but it's not impossible either. Amen. Our closing hymn is I Know I Can. Thank you. Friends, reach out with your hearts. And may the truth that sets us free and the hope that never dies and the love that casts out fear lead us forward together until the day spring breaks and all shadows flee away.